Time to talk climate and weather now with our guest, Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. He's with us now. John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, will be along just as soon as his class is over.
Right. He's a good guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're talking about the history of television, and we didn't mention weather at all, but if you think the last 20 years or so of weather forecasting and how weather people use that medium of television, it's changed a lot.
Oh, yeah. The way data or weather is presented now compared to like the 1970s is just totally different. I mean, back in the 70s, we were just really entering, some of the age of satellites and in some regard, the age of radar for applications for forecasting. And so back in the 70s, I mean, basically your weather forecast was, you know, like a weather map with a sunny smile pasted on there and strings. And it's just totally. And you can see this if you rent a Rosemary's Baby. I think that came out in the 70s.
Yeah.
And at some point during that movie, she's in bed, I think, and she's watching television. And actually, she's watching a weather forecast. And so if you get there to look at it, you can see what it was like back then. It's just...
It's a lot different.
Oh, it's a lot different, yeah.
Well, tell you what, you may have a question for Steve, and if you do, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And matter of fact, Bob in Madison's online. So let's go to Bob. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I've got a question. I go out to Blue Mountain State Park to see the sunset a lot because they have a tower there and you can see about 50 miles out. And oftentimes, I'd say 50% of the time, even if it's totally clear out, right at sunset, just before it hits the horizon, it'll cloud up on the horizon. Do you have any explanation for that?
So when you say cloud up, what does that look like?
It looks like just clouds just on the horizon, and the sun will kind of go behind the clouds before it sets.
You know, it it may not be a cloud. It may be refraction or the bending of light, and in essence, causing a mirage. Because actually, when you see the sun setting, as light passes from the sun through the atmosphere, it bends, and it bends a lot when the sun is low in the sky. And so, actually, when we actually see the sun sitting on the horizon, it's actually already below the horizon. It's just that the light has been bent around so that even though it's obscured from our view, if we didn't have an atmosphere, but because if we have an atmosphere, the light gets bent and we see it.
And so we still see that round...
We still see the round ball. And sometimes you'll only see half of the round ball. And that's what I'm wondering about, if it looks like a cloud. It's just really not a cloud there, but it's just the mirage is only bending up part of the... sun up into our view or into your view.
That's interesting.
Well, I'll look for that next time.
Yeah. You know, and another thing you can do is to see if it's the same thing is if you get books of photos of the sun, sometimes you'll see that particularly over water. You know, you'll see actually part of it will actually just be missing, will be cut out.
Interesting.
That's the only thing I can think of because I wouldn't expect for any particular reason that you would generally see cloudiness on the horizon and not up above.
Yeah. Strange.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll look for that.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Earlier this month, Milwaukee celebrated the anniversary of the city's lowest barometric pressure on record. On April 3rd, 1982, the pressure bottomed out at 28.71 inches of mercury. First, tell us, explain barometric pressure and why people pay any attention to it, and then talk about that as a significant event or not.
Yeah, I'm going to let John talk about the significance of that, particularly with regard to its record, because what it generally heralds is that there's a storm in the vicinity. What barometric pressure is it's the weight of the air above us. I mean, that's how I like to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a minimum in your pressure, that means you don't have much air above you, which generally means that air from around you is rushing in. to fill that void, if you will, of air. And so generally that means we got strong winds, and it's usually associated with a storm system. Now, the challenging thing about that is that if you think of it as the weight of the air above you, well, then the pressure should always be lower over Denver than they are in Milwaukee, because it's higher, and so it's going to have less air. So one of the things that the meteorologists always have to do is to correct that measurement to sea level. So we always are adding factors. So if you look on a weather map with regard to barometric pressure, it's all normalized to sea level so that we can actually see what the changes are from one city to the next.
Cool.
But that's a pretty low pressure that I'm sure John remembers very well.
Oh, Armando in Galena, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Armando.
Yes, good morning, Larry, and good morning. I have a question. I live in Galena in a little farm about 2 miles east of the Mississippi River. And when I look in the internet at the radar of the weather, the prevailing winds are usually from west to east. But very, very often my wind vane on my silo is, it tells me that the winds are coming from the east. So I was wondering if it is the hills of Joe Davis that turn the wind around, or what do you think happens? Because it's amazing that, you know, usually we get wind from the east in my place, but the prevailing winds are from the west.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would bet it's a local feature. So either a hill, or even if you have a stand of trees, you know, not just one tree, but a bunch of them around the silo, then what'll happen is the air flows around the hill or that obstacle, you can generate eddies that will make swirls of wind. And if the patterns are right and the topography is right or the obstacle's in the right direction, it could, you know, give you the direction from the wrong way.
I have a hill behind the farm, but it's about half a mile. And then, but I also, one of my questions or my theory was that probably because the Mississippi River has so much water, it's always evaporating, that creates kind of a void, and the prevailing winds are much higher than the kind of the local wind, so that evaporation brings air in, and that's why I get the air from the east instead of the west. It's not all the time, but...
Yeah, no, I'm not sure. I mean, the evaporation is an interesting theory, but I wonder if the Mississippi River, even though it's big, would be too narrow. To see that impact. I think your idea of like a hillside or some other obstacle generating an eddy that could turn the wind around, you know, in a more sustained manner would be what I'd be looking for.
You know, and it's interesting thinking about fishing and musky fishing, where especially before we had electric trolling motors to kind of pull us against the wind a little bit, you'd be on one side of the lake and you'd be blowing the opposite direction that you want. And so let's go up the other end of the lake and be blown, you know, the right way. And it turns, it would blow you again in a totally different direction. And it was these eddies, probably.
Yep. And then also in the lake, if they're big lakes too, then as the, you could also get a turning of the wind. Because as the wind comes out onto the lake, friction weakens. And so the wind will speed up and actually turn to the right. But it would have to be, you know, I think in terms of a river, although the Mississippi is pretty broad up there by you, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it might have enough.
Might have enough there.
But it wouldn't turn at 180 degrees.
It was frustrating getting blown and fighting against the wind. And all right, let's just go down to the other end and then just come back along the same shore. And you get to the other end and it's pushing you the wrong way.
Right?
Oh, thanks, Armando. Appreciate it. Andy in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
A couple of quick questions. One is, you know, this recent spate of cold weather we had after, you know, we had some normal temperatures. In the fall, we'd call that Indian winter. Or Indian summer, I'm sorry. I was wondering, I've been calling it Indian winter. Is there a more proper term for that?
Well, John Martin just joined us. John, did you catch all that or not?
I caught the end. I think the proper response is crummy weather. I don't know if there's anything better than that, actually. Actually, I don't know.
In the fall, there's some sort of autumnal reflux or something like that.
Indian summer.
Indian summer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you get that warming period usually in late October, early November.
Okay.
But yeah, I haven't heard anything called in springtime. You know, what would we call that?
I don't know.
Crummy weather.
Crummy weather, I think it's
But, you know, the thing is that one of the things that's interesting about both of those seasons, they're about 6 months apart. And, you know, in the autumn, you're transferring from summer to winter. And so you're kind of still have a residual of summer around. And when you're translating from winter to spring to summer, you still have a residual of winter around. And if the clouds are in the sky in April, you can forget the temperature getting above 50 degrees most days. On the other hand, under exactly the same conditions, if the sun's out, temperature's almost always above 50 degrees in April. So cloud cover is a big factor in this crummy weather problem that you sometimes get in April.
Actually, now I'm thinking now in southern Wisconsin anyway, there's a period in January, like in the January 22nd, 24th, where all of a sudden it warms up.
Yeah, that's statistically significant,
apparently. Yeah, and so there, so maybe even though we're having this, as John calls, crummy weather, maybe it's just natural variability, and we don't see a statistical signature of it like we do with Indian summer and this January thaw.
Yeah,
Yeah, and tobacco farmers in Wisconsin know that that time of the year very well, because that's when the moisture in January, there's more moisture in the air, and that's at a time when the farmers can take the tobacco that is still on the stalks and hand pick it off and put it into bales for sale
crumbling
later, and it won't crumble. It won't crumble all up. Well, we could do a great song on maybe to the tune of Stormy Weather. Call it Crummy Weather. Thanks, Andy. Thanks a lot for calling. We're talking climate and weather today with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We hope you'll join in, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back with Steve and John. Stay with us. Talking climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Thanks for listening in. You know what? We've had some people waiting a long time, so I think we'll just go right back to the phones.
Good.
Let's do that. Larry in Altoona, thanks for waiting. Hello. Oh, I suppose. I should be there. Larry, are you there? Oh, just a second.
I'm here.
Yep.
Oh, got you now. Okay.
Okay, say Saturday, watching the sky, it was crystal clear blue, and all of a sudden I would see large clouds appear and then disappear within a matter of minutes. What happens up there?
You mean they blew in, or did they just sort of develop?
They developed and then they disappeared.
Okay.
And what time of day was it again?
Oh, must have been around noon, 1 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, those are generally cumulus clouds that form generally because of solar heating. So the sun heats the surface up, and the air next to it gets warm, and that air rises, and then it hits the dew point because as it cools, the relative humidity goes up, and boom, a cloud forms, and then a short time later, it mixes with the air around it and goes away.
Oh, I've seen it many times. I always wanted to ask that. So.
Yeah, they're fun to watch.
They sure are.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Do you see any good shapes? You know, like bunnies or...
They're pretty much like globs of cotton balls up there, you know.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for calling. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello, fellas. Hello. Last night I watched a beautiful storm pass in the southern sky. Lots of mostly cloud-to-cloud lightning. I couldn't hear any thunder. How could that be?
Well, you can see the lightning from a lot farther away sometimes than you think. And I'm wondering if it wasn't. What time of day was it, Mike?
9 o'clock.
Yeah, 9 o'clock. I think that was the same thing we were kind of feeling here. And It was presaged, I think, at my home by some rain and a little bit of thunder, but not much, but that the later stuff was well to our south. I don't know what the audio range is for thunder, but it might be, what do you think it is, Steve? An order of 60 or 100 miles or something? If you're that far away, you're not going to hear it.
I would think so, yeah. And it also is going to be a function of the temperature structure of the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's also true. Yeah. And so you can see the lightning from 100 or 60 miles away, and sometimes you're just too far out of range to hear the thunder. And people talk about heat lightning a lot in the summertime, you know, this lightning that's on the distant horizon, or that they see it, and they can't really even pinpoint where it's coming from, but it comes with no thunder, and they think, oh, that's a different kind of lightning. And really what it is it's just lightning from a storm that's so remote from you that you just can't hear the associated thunder.
Did you get any rain from that storm?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
Where were you?
I'm on the west side.
So am I, and I didn't get any rain.
Yeah, you know, and it's a lot like, was it Saturday night? There was also some showery activity. and or maybe it was Friday night, one of those two nights, and they were just these very quick downpours, and I was imagining as I was listening to them hitting my window, boy, I bet you there's people not far away who aren't getting anything, and it'll just go right through the neighborhood, hit one half of the street and not the other. And that's the nature of the way it looked on the radar, too. Really small-scale little convective towers.
And you think the lightning was just too far away?
Yeah, by 9 o'clock, I think it certainly was, yeah.
Yeah, I actually went on the Internet and looked at the radar imagery because I was wondering if it was going to be coming up with us, and it was to the south of Madison.
Yeah, yeah. That's same for sure. Same yeah. I
and I didn't get any rain up by us. We're on the north end of the Mendota Lake there.
We're on the kind of the south end of Lake Monona, and we got our rain.
Yeah.
Came down pretty hard.
Yeah, thunderstorm is very centralized and very sporadic. So, yeah, in fact, I've seen it in particularly if you live in the west, because you have lots of trees and you know a lot of view, where you could look down, you could see that the road is just soaked, you know, up ahead, and where you are, it's perfectly dry.
Yeah, perfectly dry. Just,
right. That's neat.
Mary in Spring Green, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have observed over many years that sometimes the clouds move in one direction. And the surface winds move in the opposite direction, and that was happening out in Spring Green this morning. And I'm just curious what brings that about, and does it cause any problem for airplanes landing and taking off?
That's a good question. The first one especially. The winds can be from different directions at different levels in the atmosphere, and that's what you're testifying to here, Mary. The winds at the surface are one direction, and the winds at the cloud level, which is in some cases today especially well above the surface because the cloud base is pretty high, are at a different direction. How that comes about has to do with some of the structures that exist in the atmosphere. Particularly today, there's a warm front to our south. It's much warmer, and the air is moister to our south. And I'm going to guess that you saw surface winds with some component from the east, and then the winds at levels above the surface were with a component from the southwest is going to be my guess. And that would be exactly the kind of wind structure that you'd see in the vicinity of a warm front. And it does have implications for aviation, but particularly when the weather flares up and becomes severe, and then they have to really worry about wind speed and direction changes at different heights. On a day like today where it's pretty clear around these clouds, it's probably not as big a concern, but it can be an issue.
Is that what you call wind shear?
Yes, ma'am. Yep. And there's two kinds. This kind is in the vertical direction, so one would be able to call it vertical wind shear, and that's dangerous. And then there can be wind direction changes in the horizontal, which we call horizontal wind shear. And this vertical wind shear is the one that really gets airplanes.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. I remember reading that a few years back about a plane that was coming in for a landing, and just before it touched down, literally it was moved off the runway to the ground right next to it. I mean, the wind shear just pulled it right over.
And that's probably in the context of a thunderstorm where these things are just concentrated beyond belief. What I think Mary was talking about is on a bigger scale than that, and therefore not as violent.
Norm in Madison, your turn. Hi, Norm.
Hello, John and Steve.
Hi.
You guys forecast weather in terms of probability. You tell me things like there's a 40% chance of rain or a storm today, and yet I know that it either rains or it doesn't rain, and it's one or zero. So I understand that probability is a hard thing for us to understand. How does this limit your hopes that we'll do the right thing?
You're kind of breaking up a little bit.
I heard the question.
You got the question there, John?
Yeah. You want to?
No, go for it.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. It's a binary universe. It either rains or it doesn't. But we're presented with observations that are incomplete. We're presented with numerical forecast products from these numerical weather prediction models that are trying their best to take those incomplete observations and give us a sense of what's going to happen in the future. So when you hear from a meteorologist that there's a 50% chance of showers, what that means can mean two different things. I think sometimes it can mean 50% of the people who are reading this message may experience a rain shower today. That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is, then that would be because they're so scattered. Another way to think of it would be, boy, if I were presented with the same exact information and had to make a forecast from this information 10 times in a row, I'll bet you that 5 times out of those 10, we would have ended up with a rain event. 5 of those other times, we wouldn't have. And so you say, seeing this kind of information, it isn't a slam dunk, but I'd say it's about a 50% chance that these conditions are going to lead to rain broadly in the area. And that's what I would say about this afternoon. Something in that range.
And I suppose that there are times when a forecaster has more information or is more sure of himself or herself than at other times. So you can
and you adjust the probability that way. It's not uncommon at all to see when there's a big rain event coming, especially one in the winter or the spring that's not got this thunderstorm aspect to it. You'll see the Weather Service say chance of rain 100%. And they mean it's going to be widespread for the whole county warning area. There's nobody's going to escape it.
I mean, so, we just heard about how precipitation was that on Saturday was just very just between people who live in four different places all in the same city.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you're dealing with that convective range, it's just really hard to pinpoint where it's going to occur.
That's right.
Tom in Madison, your turn next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
The last two questions are really a good setup for me because one of the things I think is interesting is that weather people, particularly more so than other scientists, get trained in how do you share science with the general public. I was wondering if Steve could talk to us about the class that he teaches on campus and some of the things that they'll be doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I teach a class, it's a graduate level class across campus. Not just for atmospheric scientists, but for people in the sciences in general, or mathematics or engineering. And what it's about is learning how to communicate your research to the public at large. And we teach a class every Thursday. I was actually initially developed with Sharon Dunwoody, and now I'm teaching it with Heather Daniels. And we have a group of our students is going to be explaining their research at Wednesday night at the lab, which is occurring this Wednesday. So if you look into Wednesday night at the lab, you're going to be able to see a potpourri of research that's occurring on this campus from a variety of graduate students who are trained in communicating their research to the public. So they'll be able to explain it well.
And that's open to
It's open to anybody. That's right. Yep.
Wednesday night at the lab, and location and so forth.
It's in the biotech building, and I don't remember what time it is, and I should find that out because I obviously will be there.
You're one of the presenters, or you're going to be viewing at least.
Right, I want to go see what they're saying.
I think they have a website.
Yeah, they do. If you just search on the UW main page for Wednesday night at the lab, I think it's probably it's after work, so it'll be in the evening, 6 o'clock, 6:30, something like that.
Wednesday night at the lab. Go to the UW-Madison website and you'll find it.
Right. Yep.
Thanks, Tom.
Or email me and I can find that. I can send you the time, too.
What's your email?
steva@ssec.wisc.edu.
Oh, what was that again, Steve?
steva@ssec.wisc.edu.
.wisc.edu. Okay.
It'll be a fun time.
Yeah.
All right. And before we go back to the phones, I do want to get back to this barometric pressure business because I'm sometimes accused of forgetting things that I promote and with good justification. So I do want to go back to Milwaukee. April 3rd, they celebrated the lowest barometric pressure on record. The anniversary of it was April 3rd, 1982, 28.71 inches of mercury. That's pretty...
That's way down there. That's in the high 960s in terms of millibars. There's two different units, and they can be converted from one to the other. And we usually refer to it nowadays in millibars. Or maybe that's just in our science. I don't know. But I tried to do it quickly in my head. It's in the high 960s.
It's like a hurricane.
That's pretty low. Yeah, there are hurricanes with pressures that high. The all-time lowest pressure for mid-latitude cyclone that I'm aware of is something in around 920 millibars, which is even lower than that, of course. In fact, quite a bit lower than that. And not many hurricanes get that low. The really extreme hurricanes, Hurricane Rita, was down about 887 millibars or something the order of that, so below 900. And the standard sea level pressure is just over 1,000. And so when you get down below 900 millibars, what you're saying is that column of air has about 11% of the mass of the atmosphere taken out of it, which is a huge job to do. I mean, that's extraordinarily large.
Well, we wouldn't get hurricanes here, so what would Milwaukee likely have gotten back in 1982 as a result of that?
I guess it depends on what side of the storm they were on. That was quite a week, because 3 days later, we had an April blizzard when I was a senior in high school, and that was unforgettable in Massachusetts. That was about 2 feet of snow, April 6th, 1982. So I'll bet if they were on the western side of that thing, it was a major snowstorm. If they were on the eastern side of it, it was a tremendous rainstorm with extraordinary winds. In either case, extraordinary winds, probably really windy, 50-knot winds.
I told you he would remember.
And by the way, the Wednesday night at the lab, is 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. All right, good. I got time to eat dinner.
And it's in room 1360 of the Biotechnology Center on Henry Mall, which is across from one of my offices, too, sort of kitty corner across. So 7 o'clock, 1360 Biotech Center on Henry Mall. Joe in Centura, it's your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Good show. I had two comments. One from the one of the early callers talked about the seeing the cloud formation, you know, right at sunset, and you know, wondering, you know, what caused that. And I guess I had a kind of in the opposite situation. I've hunted up in the Cable, Wisconsin area for a number of years, and you'd be out, you know, of course, early in the morning before sunrise, and it'd be just clear as a bell. And you know, the minute the sun popped up, you know, you'd all of a sudden you'd see, you know, these clouds would form. And I'm just wondering if that was the opposite effect of what's going on at the sunset, that as the, you know, the temperature changes, you know, in that aspect, that's what he was seeing too, is you know, some cloud formation as the sunlight and the heat.
So when you see your clouds, are they up ahead or are they down blocking part of the sun?
They always, you know, it's, like I said, you're always watching the horizon or as much of the horizon you can see, and it just, you know, as the sun just, you know, just peaks up over the horizon, all of a sudden, you know, you'll get the cloud formation, and it'll, you know, it'll cloud up all of a sudden there, and you know, these clouds start to form right away. And I can imagine some of that is just, you know, the heat from the sun, you know, actually, you know, starting some of that formation.
Yeah, two things. I mean, you're right that when the sun comes up early in the morning, it starts to heat the ground, and that generates low-level cloud cover like we talked about earlier, where the cloud all of a sudden will just form and then go away in a short amount of time. But if you're seeing the sun all of a sudden get blocked out, particularly by like a layer-type cloud, then that's probably the same thing we talked about earlier, where it's not necessarily a cloud, but the almost a mirage that you'd be seeing that would be blocking it out.
Right, right. Yeah. And the other comment from the lady talked about the wind shear and the different wind at different altitudes. And I'm a retired air traffic controller, and you know, we'd always get reports from pilots, you know, that they'd be flying along or on final approach, and they'd be you know, saying, well, at 3,000 feet the wind is, you know, 270 at 10, and on the ground it's, you know, 180 at 5 or something like that, and it was always different, you know, and you know, that it was always good reports of knowing what was happening up at the different altitudes. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you'd get tons and tons of these reports, and they'd always, you know, question sometimes the wind on the ground, and they tell you, well, the wind up here is, you know, we're getting a tailwind. And, you know, our response is, well, it's a good thing you're not landed at 3,000 feet then.
Yeah, right. You
know, but the difference would change, and especially, I worked at Milwaukee, and the lake effect was terrific. I mean, you know, for 2 miles out on final, if you're landing toward the east, you know, you'd have a tailwind until you got, you know, just about at the shoreline.
Oh, yeah, the lake breeze. Yeah.
And it would change. So those are my comments. So
great.
Those are excellent.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Joe. Appreciate it. And by the way, if you have some comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast. And Bob in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. This morning we had a very light hailstorm. I shouldn't call it a storm, but some hail. I heard a little thunder first. And being a rather cool morning, normally we get hail on a warm day when we're having a kind of a little more threatening type of weather pattern. But we did have the thunder, and then followed by just a quick flurry of hailstones under a half inch, and then not much rain. It opened up later on to having a minor rain. Right now it's raining out here. But I thought it was rather strange the way it came, because normally we get hail preceding a major storm. So that's my comment.
Yeah, this was a really interesting morning. There were so many, and consistent with what you're saying, I saw some other interesting things that are exactly along those lines. It looks like a midsummer sky around the southern part of the state today with what are called altocumulus castellanus. They're usually a harbinger of some severe weather that's coming in the summertime, almost always. Today, I think what we're seeing is that the instability that's often associated with the development of these kinds of weather systems that might drop hail on you or give you thunder and lightning, that instability is not reaching all the way down to the ground, and so it's a mid-level instability. But it's just as potent if you can get it to, if you can get the air to rise. And I think there's plenty of reason for that to be happening this morning, which makes it a quite an interesting day. The thing that's mostly consistent with it is, I noticed this here in Madison, the incredible height of the cloud base this morning. It's yeah. very unusual for us to get precipitation with such high cloud bases. And that's, again, consistent with the instability being concentrated and located in the middle part of the troposphere, not based all the way to the ground like it often is in the summertime.
Hmm. Thanks, Bob.
Often you see like a roll cloud coming in before a thunderstorm that has hail.
Yeah.
And there was nothing like that at all.
No, this was all mid-level. And those are ones where the instability comes all the way down to the surface, and it's much more potent as a result. You have a lot more volume of air involved in the whole circulation.
Thanks, Bob, for calling. Appreciate it. Heather and Ladysmith, your turn. Hi, Heather.
Good afternoon. I'm going to keep it with the airplane theme. I had heard, I don't know how long ago, there was some research that was suggesting that airplane contrails were causing more rain clouds to form, and I was just wondering if you could speak to that. Do you know when they launch at Cape Canaveral or the contrails that we see from the jumbo jets, do they really create more rain clouds? And I'll listen to my answer off the air. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally not. And the reason why is that they're up high in the atmosphere, and so generally they're also not flying around storms that are developing when you see them. Now, there are times where it can generate precipitation, and that is if you have a mid-level cloud that has a lot of water, liquid water in it, and then if you have a contrail above and the air is really moist up high, those contrails consist of ice particles. And if those ice particles can grow large enough, then they'll fall down. And if they can fall into the lower level water cloud, they can do what we call seed the cloud. And so they can turn the liquid water droplets in that cloud into ice and make them grow really fast. And then that can initiate a precipitation. Yeah. But that doesn't occur that often. And when it does, it's really kind of fascinating because you can see this theory in action. But it doesn't occur that often.
Thanks, Heather. Paul in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hello. The gentleman mentioned before that a barometer was measuring the mass of the atmosphere in terms of air pressure. And I really don't think that's true because air pressure is a fluid, and at any given depth, the fluid pressure should be the same. What I think is being measured is the momentum of the air mass. Mm. If it's a low-pressure system, it's traveling upwards. And it's just like when you blow on a piece of paper, it, you know, it'll cause pressure on that side. It's not that the pressure is due to the mass of the air. It's due to the motion of the air.
What do you think, John?
It's a combination, but the predominant factor is the mass of the air. That is, the pressure is the force divided by the area. So the mass of the air column is the predominant thing that determines the pressure in that column. In fact, it entirely determines what's known as the hydrostatic pressure. And there are such things as non-hydrostatic pressures that arise from the motions of air parcels, but they're usually very, very small, 0.1% of the total pressure as a result of the motion of the air on average. Hmm. So it's mostly the mass.
Mostly the mass.
And it has to do with the distance between the particles or density? Or
well,
you can think of it on the micro scale as well, where the individual molecules are exerting a pressure as they hit the object.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. As you put more of them together, then you're going to increase the pressure. But if you, the way you get more of them together is to have more air above you.
Because you can compress the air.
Because you compress the air. So those two thoughts of the what I'll call the micro scale, which is the thinking of the molecules bumping into objects, as well as the macro scale, which is the larger weight, are actually consistent with one another.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's just the easier to think of it as the weight of the atmosphere above you.
Right. Thank you very much for calling, Paul. Appreciate it. And John and Steve, boy, it flew by.
Wow. Yeah.
It sure did.
You'll be back the last Monday of May.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is that Memorial Day? Probably is.
I'm not sure. I can't remember. It could well be.
It's not Mother's Day.
It's not Mother's Day. Thanks, guys. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. at UW-Madison and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. They'll be back the last Monday of the month. We'll do this all over again. Just to mention, coming up tomorrow, Peter Green of InfoStar has some advice for those of you who use personal computers. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.